Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking in urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guest today is Lena Liaku. Lena is Managing Director for Europe and the Middle East at Global Cities Network, which is the successor to the Rockefeller Foundation's 100 Resilient Cities, where she had a similar role. And before that, Lena was Deputy Mayor of Thessalonica in Greece, and she has an extensive background focused on cities and resilience at the national and international level. And that's the topic of today's podcast. Lena, welcome to City Talks.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I should say before we start that we're recording this on the 20th of March, so it's a particularly timely discussion given the situation that cities and countries around the world are facing in relation to the coronavirus. And I think it's not just the medical challenges that the virus brings, but also the social and economic implications and impacts that flow from it. And we'll get onto those issues very shortly. But before we do that, Lena, can you just start with an introduction to city resilience? You know, what is it? Why is it important? You know, where has it come from as a kind of idea, as a set of ideas? And how does it play out in different circumstances? So, you know, just give us that sort of sense as the background of city resilience.
Sure, thank you. So urban resilience is the capacity of the systems within a city to survive, adapt, and grow, no matter what are the stresses and shocks that they experience. So in other words, urban resilience is about strengthening the city's underlying fabric and tackling challenges and creating solutions in an integrated, inclusive, and forward-looking manner. So most cities work in silos. There are, you know, there's one team designing emergency plans, there's another team exploring sustainability issues, another one focused on livelihoods. But cities are systems, are not silos. So business as usual models of reactive planning will not generate the strength and flexibility that we need to face the challenges of the 21st century. So this is where we see the power of integrating the resilience thinking into our urban governance. Now, urban resilience has been part of the global discussion for the last 10 to 15 years. The root of urban resilience comes from disaster risk and disaster risk reduction and disaster risk management. But throughout the last decade, urban resilience is seen as a broader issue. It's a way of acting and thinking of how we create our cities and how we future-proof our systems. And this broader concept was needed because the cities have become also more complex systems. So it's not just trying to face and survive a crisis, but it's all the different elements, direct and indirect impacts that are created because of this crisis.
And so part of that is the recognition. You talked a little bit about the sort of disaster relief, which is, I think you think about that as a kind of acute issue that needs to be dealt with in the short term and in, you know, immediately almost, but also there's a recognition in resilience about this kind of longer term chronic, you know, how you prepare for and deal with things that are not necessarily episodic but actually play out over time. Is that right?
Yes, and when we're talking about shocks, we're talking about earthquakes, hurricanes. When we talk about stresses, we are talking about aging infrastructure, unemployment, inadequate health systems, for example. What is important to understand is that a crisis, so a shock, can worsen an existing stress, and vice versa, which means that because of the underlying issues and the stresses that the city has, the impact of a shock can be exacerbated because of them. So unless we address all of them together, we will never be able to say that we have a livable and resilient city.
And so that if that's the sort of evolution of the concept of resilience, just say a little bit about, you know, what's your thinking around why cities have become the domain for, you know, for resilience thinking. Is that connected to, you know, broad patterns of urbanization that we see, you know, cities becoming hubs, not just economic hubs, but social hubs, cultural hubs, demographic hubs? Is that part of the process as well?
Yeah, so the basic triggers that made this kind of shift around thinking about the importance of urban resilience were urbanization. More and more people are going to cities and living in cities, globalization, and climate change. So these were, let's say, the triggers that made the global community to focus on understanding how can we future-proof our systems, how we can future-proof our communities in the face of different challenges that, you know, we cannot even expect and we cannot even foresee. So urban resilience actually is an agnostic, it needs to be agnostic to the shock or stress. It's a way of, it's a process of building these foundations inside our cities.
And your involvement in the Global Cities Network, the Resilience Network, and obviously prior to that, the 100 Resilient Cities. I mean, you were looking and engaging with cities across the globe. Is there an easy way to sort of characterize how different cities in different places are, A, thinking about the concept of resilience, but then putting the thinking into action? You know, do we see some trends and some patterns that we can draw out?
So the Global Resilience Cities Network, as you said, is a network of cities and chief resilience officers committed in building their urban resilience to future-proof their systems and protect their communities, and especially the most vulnerable. This is an important aspect. We've been working with almost 100 cities from across the globe to try to understand what does it mean to build resilience. And although the principles are the same and the qualities of what is a resilient system, each city adapts this thinking according to their own needs and local context. So also resilience means different things in, for different cities and regions and countries. An example. In the UK, resilience is directly connected with civil contingencies. There is a tradition around resilience. There are policies, processes, acts. There was a strong understanding of the connection, starting from disaster management to reduction to going towards a broader concept of resilience. In other cities or regions, an example would be the Netherlands, with, for example, Rotterdam and The Hague that are member cities, where resilience actually is around adapting and adaptation to, it started from water, now has moved to social resilience, but the entry point was adaptation and climate adaptation. In other cases, and this was this is relevant for my hometown in Thessaloniki, resilience actually brought and was conceived as a strategic framework of acting. So it has, how do we understand how all of the things that we're doing, all our investments, the way that we are acting connects, and how we can streamline in a sense, and we can ensure that what we do actually has impact on the ground. So resilience again means different things to different countries and cities, but in the end, what we support the cities in doing is to try to integrate the principles, the thinking, and also support them into learning from each other, especially because each city has different strengths and interprets resilience in a slightly different way.
Yeah, and so well, it'd be interesting in your thoughts around, you know, some of those cities that are more, you know, are more resilient. But in terms of resilient thinking and resilient preparation, is it simply a case that wealthier cities or more empowered cities, you know, cities that sit in more, you know, federalized systems like Germany, as opposed to the UK, but then you've got places like London that are, you know, super wealthy. Is it simply a case that wealthier cities or more empowered cities devote more activity to resource planning and more thinking?
Not necessarily. So first of all, there is no such thing as like a fully resilient city. Resilience is an ongoing process. And governments need to consciously invest and think on resilience, regardless whether they are wealthy or poor. There are certain criteria or certain, let's say, enablers to ensure that the city is towards the trajectory of becoming resilient. So an important element is how we create an effective governance structure. And this is, for example, the role of the chief resilience officer. Is the point of contact that horizontally works across the silos and ensures that what the politicians are thinking and what the technocrats are thinking is aligned, what the stakeholders outside the city want to do with what the city is doing are also complementary, what are the global issues and the local issues. So being able to connect all of this. A second element is inclusiveness. Be ensuring that you take into consideration all the different communities and not just, you know, the usual suspects, the formal stakeholders of the cities, but actually these communities that don't participate in the day-to-day operations of the city, that are the most vulnerable. The third element is having a data-driven decision-making. And data is an important element. Being able to monitor what you're doing, how you're doing it, reflect, learn, and iterate. And the learning piece is very important, being reflective. Because things will happen, crises will happen, but how do you learn from them and how you integrate this learning is very important. In terms of overall governance structures, indeed, it seems that decentralization supports resilience, because a city is more flexible, is more agile in order to define their own policies. They have the fiscal opportunities as fiscal powers to actually implement those priorities as well.
You know, why do some cities, you know, why are some cities part of your network, and I suppose some cities are not, in a sense? Do you have a sense as to why some cities take, you know, resilience more seriously than others? If it's not a straightforward sort of they've got more resources to play with and therefore, you know, they can deploy it into more policy areas, is it because they are particularly threatened by natural disaster or a certain set of circumstances? I mean, how would you predict the cities that would take it more seriously if you were coming afresh?
So the way that we selected those cities, and there were a series of open calls, so the cities had to apply, the criteria were, the most important is a strong mayoral commitment. The political personnel, the leadership of the city, needs to understand that this is a priority. Otherwise, agencies and departments inside cities can do whatever they want, but unless there is a priority and a resilience is not on top of the agenda, we cannot see actual change. The second element that we were interested in was to create proof points and understand what resilience means in different contexts. So we have big metropolises such as London and New York and Los Angeles, but we also have small cities such as Vejle, for example, in Denmark, or Byblos in Lebanon. Because actually resilience is not for the wealthy and not for the big cities. Resilience actually, where we've seen more success is in these secondary cities that because of their size are able to experiment, learn, and iterate and experiment again and pilot and then institutionalize internally. So my suggestion in general is unless there is a strong political commitment, it's difficult to build resilience. Another element that is important, and we've seen it through our work from the cities, is when you actually have a disaster, this is where resilience comes on top. The problem is how you create this urgency in cities that have not, you know, they have forgotten what the crisis is. So this is why it is very important. It's very important and it's very And now with a global crisis, I think actually resilience has already been part of the discourse, and we need to use this momentum to not only say let's bounce back, but let's bounce back better and let's build our cities better. And it's not just surviving all of this, but actually thriving through all of this.
Is it often that I'm curious around, you know, that sort of the, as you were saying, the political leadership and where it kind of comes from, particularly differentiating, you know, bigger, wealthier, I suppose, metropolises like London, which I would expect to be doing some of the things, and then some of the smaller places that are probably doing it for a slightly different set of reasons. But can you say something about whether the experience of a crisis or, you know, an acute experience, a disaster of some shape or form, does that sometimes act as the stimulant for an engagement? Then, you know, we've experienced this. We've clearly seen that our city and our systems were ill-prepared, and that's galvanized action and political leadership to then say, you know, we can't have this happen again. So that's why they get into this sort of space.
Yes, there is a term which is not in my term of office. not in my backyard. So politicians in general tend to avoid any discussions around this, and also that means that they avoid investing in preparedness. It's just that they prefer to be in denial. But when a crisis actually hits, this is where we see a change. And also it is a time issue. You need to act within, I think it's like 6-9 months after the disaster. This is like the window to make very important and critical changes policy-wise. Afterwards, people go to the business as usual kind of ways of life. Now, a very good example and very prominent is the New Orleans case after Hurricane Katrina. And we actually worked through the 100 Resilient Cities program with the city there. And in Katrina, what it was very evident is, yes, this was an intense hurricane. It was a Category 3 storm, but the impact was much more intense because of the chronic stresses that the city had in terms of institutional racism, violence, aging infrastructure, environmental degradation. So when Hurricane Katrina hit, these deep-seated weaknesses were exposed, which meant that bouncing back was even more difficult. The positive thing is that with strong leadership of the city, the city understood that they had to rethink their policies and procedures horizontally. So on the one hand, they emphasized and they worked around building green infrastructure and changing this this concept of building over the water. And they moved towards actually moving back from the water or adapting and living with the water. But at the same time, they invested in improving the well-being of the population and addressing the underlying issue of social inequality. So, for example, they created an agency which is the Network for Economic Opportunity, especially focused for these populations. They also created processes internally. They had a new process of how they assess their budget and their capital investments and putting a lens on resilience on top of it. So New Orleans is a very good example. There are many others that they used the experience of the crisis and of the disaster to actually, again, bounce back better.
And what's your sense, Lena, in that scenario? You know, given the geographical location, the physical location of New Orleans, you know, where it's literally sited, low lying, you know, on the extensive sort of river network, what's your sense as to why some of the thinking that you've just set out, why wasn't that there, you know, prior to the flooding? I mean, I suppose that's an obvious, I don't know, is that an obvious question in terms of, you know, given the circumstances, I mean, one would expect, or was that just because, as you said, you know, politicians and systems tend to adapt to circumstances when they experience them rather than sort of forethink them or, you know, prepare for them sufficiently well?
So first of all, it has to do with the belief that we are stronger than nature. So we believe that engineering can solve everything. And we've seen it not only in New Orleans, but in almost all coastal cities that build, you know, and try to build walls and build over the cities, over the water. And now we've seen more and more cities trying to understand that actually we need to live with the water. And the water can support the economy of the city, the environment of the city, the social cohesion of the city. So this is also kind of what the Dutch have worked in and have excelled, because they proved that it is possible, and this is the right way of actually living with the water rather than seeing the water as the enemy.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. And I think that the other point you were making around, you know, the pre-existing conditions that we see in, you know, cities in terms of poverty levels, in terms of inequality, in terms of the, you know, economic and social health of that place, you know, that has a factor in the degree to which places are resilient over and above the more particular and direct resilient planning and thinking that places are doing. And these two things are, you know, interacting all the time, I guess.
Yes, I'm trying to understand the interdependencies of all these systems and also integrate this concept of the multiple benefits. That, yes, you're going to do, for example, a green space that will restore and capture water in case of flooding. Yeah. But how can this space be also a community and the social infrastructure, being part of the social infrastructure? How can it support the different communities and the different people that live around there? So being able to think in this way, this is where you're going to also maximize the impact of the resources that you're going to, that you have. And this is why it's not necessarily that you need to be a wealthy city to build resilience. It is important just to think what is the most effective way and how you can maximize the resources that you have.
Yeah. And how widespread do you think this thinking is now? I mean, obviously, you were part of the, you know, the 100 Resilient Cities Network. You know, you're carrying on that work in the sense of working with places across the globe. You know, I'm not looking for a precise figure, but how widespread now do you think that thinking is? Or, you know, is in some regards, is the 100 Network the exceptions rather than the rule? I mean, just give us a sense as to how that's playing out and whether you see this thinking slowly cascading across more and more places.
I think that urban resilience has become more mainstream the last few years. I also believe that the work that we did through the 100 Resilient Cities program, and we continue with the Global Resilient Cities Network, has supported this mainstreaming. We see a lot of cities that are outside of our network that learn from the cities that are part of the network and create their own chief resilience officers, their own strategies, incorporating these lessons. Which for us is a great sign of, you know, of that we did something right. But also we've seen other programs that also support the urban resilience thinking and work with cities. So I think that at this point we have an ecosystem of different programs, organizations that try to help cities think differently in the face of the multiple complex challenges, risks, shocks and stresses that they face. Now, the question here is, are we at the level, do we have the political commitment at the local, regional, national and supranational level around the importance of resilience? I think we need to do more. We need to do more to ensure that, you know, investment, for example, goes from the national governments to the cities to for resilience and for resilience building. So still we need to do a lot of work, but I think that the mayors across the globe, regardless of the of our network, have proven to have a better understanding of the importance of future-proofing the systems. We need to see this also happening at the other scales of government.
Okay, so let's turn to the current situation. Can you just say a little bit about how your network is engaging with cities in the, you know, given the pandemic and the coronavirus situation, and you know, to sort of give us a characterization, if you can, about how cities are both being impacted upon, but also are responding to the situation they're in.
So this is a global crisis, and the cities were once more are at the epicenter of this. The cities, the mayors with their teams have been and are trying to activate all the enablers in order to respond. And this is not easy. We're talking about a global pandemic, but we've seen even the tenacity by which the cities are acting. And we are, as a network, we are trying to help and support the cities into exchange their experience. So for example, yesterday we had a webinar, an online speaking series every week to help our member cities to discuss, share experience, share solutions, but also share their questions, their anxieties. So for example, yesterday we had the chief resilience officers from London and Milan sharing their experience and learning. Now, the cities at this point, most of them are focusing on three main elements. The one is emergency response and maintaining continuity of the critical services. The second is supporting the communities of the city that are now in self-isolation, especially the more vulnerable, that we know historically are the ones that are more impacted in times of crisis. And the third element is start thinking about recovery from day one. So what does it mean? Again, what is the learning? What are the data? How from now we need to think about how we will bounce back better? So these are the main three elements that the cities are focusing. Of course, because the crisis also is kind of goes in flows, some cities have already are deep into this for a few months, such as, you know, like Singapore or Seoul, or of course the Chinese cities, Milan and Italy has been also under lockdown for a few weeks. And we've seen how this kind of progresses. So it is very important for us to ensure the flow of information across the cities and how you connect it with experts, data and research around it.
And in that, are there sort of common strategies or common challenges that the cities are either adopting or trying to grapple with? Do you have a sort of sense as to, you know, the sort of those kind of things?
Yes. So one piece that is very interesting is the role of digital infrastructure. Michel Acuto, he's a professor at in Melbourne. He said that
I know Michele.
Okay, Michele. Digital infrastructure will be the sanitation of our time, and we've seen it. So all of our cities are trying to understand how they can use digital infrastructure, data, smart solutions in order to maintain some of the services, ensure that they connect with their citizens and communicate with their citizens. A second element is communication, transparency, how they ensure that the information goes out, how they ensure that, an example is yesterday London was telling us that they are trying to translate everything in 300 languages. And that has been difficult. So being able to ensure that the message goes out to all is critical. Third element, how you coordinate the response and how you support the vulnerable communities. Homeless, children in need, people in precarious employment, with precarious employment in the gig economy. How do you support them? Is it through tax breaks? Is it through coordinating with the charities, with the volunteer sector? How do you organize this with the private sector? And one lesson learned was you need to have friends from before. The city needs to have created and nourished these relationships with the charities, with the nonprofits, with the private sector, in order to be able now to draw back and to draw resources and work better. And the last element is, how do we recover? How do we bounce back? How do we bounce back better? I want to emphasize that. There are a lot of cities that call it the plan for day zero, which is what is happening afterwards. And again, usually after after a crisis, and especially a crisis of this size, we're going to have fundamental changes in the way that we work, we live, we experience the city. So the big challenge for all of us is how we can ensure that the people that usually lose the most during a crisis, and are usually the ones that lose even more at the aftermath, are taken care of. So the big challenge for our society and for our cities is how, through this, we can actually fix the underlying issues. And the economic and social inequalities and vulnerabilities in our cities have emerged through this crisis very strongly. So the one piece is, again, how we protect the vulnerable, how we learn from what has happened, and how we ensure we just don't go back to the status quo, but actually learn and change and evolve. And also, how do we ensure that we don't lose sight of the other big emergencies, and especially the climate emergency, which is still here. And again, there is a risk, because we will try to accelerate economic growth, that we might lose focus and lose our commitment towards fixing this planet. Yeah. And climate emergency and health emergency are interrelated. And these are questions that have come up from our cities and from our chief resilience officers, and they want to understand, and we were going to help them do that, how they build strategies and action plans and processes and policies based on the experience, based on what has happened, based on data, and how we ensure that we go towards a better future.
Yeah. And so you talked a little, you talked about the sort of city to city network, and the city to city sort of information flows and experiences and such. Lena, could you say something about, you know, through this, the pandemic, your sense of the relationship between cities and national governments on the one hand, and then cities and international institutions and organizations like the World Health Organization? I mean, how does that sort of play in that sort of vertical space as well as the horizontal space? How are cities navigating and engaging with national governments and institutions like the WHO? And I suppose, how are they in engaging with cities? I mean, how do they think about, you know, the cities as institutions, as platforms, as, you know, as places where this is playing out?
So I think at this point, the national governments are the ones that have the main powers and authorities. In general, the city's responsibilities are limited. What their role is, which is critical, is how they operationalize the policies that the national governments are taking. Even cities like London and Milan, which we consider very important hubs, still they need to follow the directions and the policies that come from above. But even how you operationalize it is what will make the difference between succeeding or not. We are a global organization, so we try to support city-to-city collaboration. I know that other similar organizations are trying to do so. I'm not, to be honest, sure what organizations such WHO is, how they are connecting at the city scale. I don't think they do. I think they connect with the national level. But it is important, and it will be interesting to see how we bridge this gap, and especially again how we learn and we prepare better for the next time.
Yeah, and I think the point you've made several times, the focus on the operational side of the issue, the practicalities of the issue, seems to me to be at least a very important role for cities to be playing, and also then to be informing, you know, national policymakers, which by definition are one step removed, about, you know, how the policies that are, you know, that are produced actually play out on the ground, and how they might need to be tweaked, both in the current situation, but also, you know, for future situations that will emerge, you know, in the future. So, in terms of going back to the experiences of the, you know, your network and the cities, in, are there? I know it's early days in the pandemic and how we're responding, but are there lessons already around that practicality and, you know, common things that are being transmitted between cities, but also up into international government that you can observe already?
Some very preliminary lessons learned, again, from what the cities have identified, is the importance of the government continuity, and what does it mean, ensuring government continuity, and, you know, understanding your critical functions, understanding your critical staff, being able to communicate with them. You know, this might be considered, you know, very simple or details, but these are critical for the success of the of emergency plans. The issues around you know, the digital transition, and I mean, the cities had overnight to transition from transition towards working from home. So this was also important. Like their question was like, why hadn't we done it before?
Yeah,
and we had to do it overnight. The second element, which I think everybody relates at this point, is how we support our healthcare staff, how we support our community volunteers, how we create robust plans for them, for the frontline staff, and ensure that we have the necessary resources to do it. And then what I also mentioned before, making friends. making friends for before will ensure that you will be able to that you'll be able to mobilize the cities. So these are very, very preliminary ones that our chief resilience officers and city members have identified, but we are in the process of trying to capture all of this. And as we move forward, we will be able to understand and capture even more. But the creativity, the ingenuity that we see, the different programs, there were a lot of cities have said, you know, we now understood the importance of the cultural sector within our city, that usually, you know, it's not at the forefront. How you support the night economy, all of these things are new, and they're not trying to understand it. And it will be very interesting to see how we take all these lessons learned. And
yeah,
you know, the positive aspects of that, and not just the negative ones.
Yeah, and I know we're in the midst of the crisis, as you know, currently, but drawn on experiences of other, you know, situations before. I mean, you alluded to them there a little bit there, but what do you think some of those impacts could be or might be, both in terms of, you know, how cities think about resilience and how they, you know, they prepare for situations, but also, I suppose, how the city itself and cities adapt to, you know, to the experiences that they've gone through. I mean, Do you have a sense as to, you know, based on previously you talked about New Orleans and how that's, you know, how that impacted upon how the city thought about the issue, but also how it impacted on the city itself and the, you know, the life of the city. So what's your, you know, if you look forward, what's your sense as to how that might play out?
So, I mean, diseases specifically have shaped cities, as we know, like yes. Modern planning and civil engineering was born out of the need to address it. So what for me is not clear is in terms of urban planning, what will be the changes? Because we, the issues of density of cities and the last few decades, we advocate towards more dense cities and more compact cities. Will this change? What do we need to understand? How do we need to adapt our thinking around that? I think on top of that, again, I will emphasize the role of the digital infrastructure, the different patterns of work, and the whole concept of working from home definitely will be integrated into how we operate. I think that the crisis, as all crises, kind of brings us closer, even if because of this crisis we are actually need to be separate. But I think that there are, we see the, you know, social cohesion and how communities that are close become even closer, how we support each other. And I think this also, it is important to keep the momentum afterwards. I think there is an issue of the right to movement, all the concept, you know, around our human rights, a privacy issue, because we're in a crisis, a lot of the privacy issues are kind of bypassed because we need the data. How we ensure that, you know, these are not just integrated into the operations and we don't end up, you know, decreasing our rights and the rights of acting in the city and moving.
What's your sense that we need, what do we need to do to avoid, you know, the lessons not being learnt and, you know, the lessons not being taken forward and, you know, the adaptation that you were talking about happening? I mean, again, from previous sort of examples of experiences, you know, what do we need to avoid doing or not doing in order for those lessons to be, you know, to be fully understood and fully responded to?
So from the perspective of global organization or international organizations or nonprofits or the civil society, it is important to keep nudging and keep advocating and keep pushing and making the politicians and the cities, the city administrations accountable. Because the issue is, if we just leave them, you know, and I'm talking as a citizen now, if we just leave them and we never, you know, ask these questions, the cities, you know, might go back to business as usual. So from a citizen's perspective and a community perspective, we need to keep advocating and need to keep that surfaced. From the international organization, we will try to support the cities as much as we can into continuing this thinking. And usually the best way is to bring them together, to share knowledge. You know, you create almost this healthy competition around what is happening. So it is a combination of also external factors, plus internally how the cities, and in the case of our cities, the chief resilience officers, in a sense, have this role of keeping the momentum, of ensuring that people think in this integrated way. But even in cities that don't have this position, trying to identify the right person, people, team, department, that from, again, day one can have this role of thinking in this way and not just deluded into the complicated structures of a city.
My guest today has been Lena Liaku. Lena, I know you're incredibly busy helping and supporting cities across the globe trying to grapple with and deal with the virus and the pandemic as it's evolving. So thank you very much indeed for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter @Centre4Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.